Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from our studios in WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a lovely spring day, though slightly overcast. If there were a Hall of Fame for on-air personalities on television in the United States, our guest today would certainly be in the entering class. Truly an icon of American broadcasting. A revolutionary figure who changed the nature of daytime television and who has gone on to have many great things and important things to say about what's going on in media in the United States today. Join us today on Media Matters for Phil Donahue. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The anti-indecency crusade in Congress just took a totalitarian turn. In an April 4th speech to executives attending the cable television industry's annual conference in San Francisco, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner suggested criminal prosecution for indecency cases. The scary thing is that Sensenbrenner, a Republican from Wisconsin, is chair of the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, which puts him in a prime position to ramrod such legislation through the House. Criminalizing indecent programming would almost certainly run afoul of the First Amendment, and Sensenbrenner hasn't detailed just how he would implement his proposal. Because cable TV is not free, it is not subject to FCC indecency regulation, although some in Congress have talked about changing that. In February, the House passed a bill to increase the maximum fine the FCC can levy in indecency cases by more than 15-fold, from $32,500 to $500,000.
Telecom companies continue their push to squelch community internet projects. Bills are pending in the state legislatures of Colorado and Texas, which would preemptively forbid cities and towns from offering broadband data services. A bill in Texas would ban the establishment of them by next year. In West Virginia, telecom corporate lobbying effectively watered down a state Senate proposal that would have guaranteed cities and towns the right to develop community internet projects. Now the legislation just calls for a study of the concept. In Arkansas, lawmakers are debating a proposal to give millions of dollars of tax breaks to companies who build out broadband networks. The state already has laws in place that restrict community internet projects. 10 states in all have implemented legal barriers to community internet development, while another 11 are debating doing so. At the federal level, however, the attitude is the opposite. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is preparing to give away some $9 million to local governments for community internet projects. This is on top of more than $30 million similarly spent over the last 3 years.
Spin masquerading as journalism is now an international problem. The British Broadcasting Corporation stands accused of airing stories from embedded reporters in Iraq who in reality were working for a company contracted by the Ministry of Defense to provide propaganda for domestic and international distribution. A recent ministry report on embedded news coverage brags that 90% of the coverage produced by embedded reporters is either positive or neutral in tone. Back in the United States, a TV reporter in Florida comes clean on moonlighting for state government. For the last 30 years, Mike Vasilindas covered the state capitol in Tallahassee for several TV stations as well as NBC and CNN. But he also has his own production company that does video reports for state agencies, so much so that he's earned more than $1 million doing it since 1996. And in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger got caught last month shilling video news releases produced by the state labor department. The propaganda videos attack teacher pay scales, nursing staff levels in hospitals, and mandatory lunch breaks for hourly workers.
The last apostolic letter written by Pope John Paul II before he died involved media and media reform. Apostolic letters are the papal equivalent to policy statements. In his last letter, written in January, John Paul called for a more democratic media with, quote, true participation in their management by all, and endorsed legislative solutions to promote diversity in media ownership. He also lamented news bias, calling on everyone to develop, quote, a healthy critical capacity regarding the persuasive force of the communications media.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. A survey of American kids and their families by the Kaiser Family Foundation suggests children spend more time on media consumption in an average weekday than their parents spend working. The study found kids spent some 6.5 hours on average daily consuming media. But today's children are masters at multitasking, like watching TV while talking on the phone or listening to music while searching the web. If you take into account multitasking, U.S. children actually spend an average of 8.5 hours a day on media consumption. Watching television is the most popular form of child media consumption, while reading books is least favorite. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, April 10, 2005, beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show for you with a guest we've long wanted to have on the air. Phil Donahue is one of the best-known talk show hosts in the history of television in the United States. He's been the host of the Emmy Award-winning TV talk show, The Phil Donahue Show, and really one of the originators of the daytime talk show format featuring panel discussions of controversial social issues, celebrity guests, and audience participation. Donahue hosted over 6,000 shows from 1967 to his final segment in 1996. Then in 2002, he returned to national television with a show on MSNBC. Phil Donahue will be in Champaign-Urbana May 10th and 11th for the Media Consolidation Conference we've been talking about here on the air, and he joins us today from his home in New York, or Connecticut, is it, Phil?
I'm in New York, Bob.
In New York. Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Phil, for joining us.
Pleasure.
And it's going to be great to have you here in town here for that conference on May 10th and 11th with you and Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, Don Henley, Representative Bernie Sanders, and all the other folks here to discuss really the state of the media today and what as citizens in a free society we can do to change the situation for the better.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I know, and we're looking forward to it too. Well, Phil, you know, let's talk first, if we can, about your most recent experience on television, which was your program on MSNBC, the nighttime show going up against O'Reilly, which was established with considerable fanfare, and lasted about a year, was the top-ranked program on the air, but sort of went down in I think, a certain amount of controversy surrounding the Iraq War. Could you just talk a little bit about your experiences with the program in general and then maybe get towards the war at the end?
Sure. The Donahue program on MSNBC was very well promoted, and I went charging back to television essentially because I was really floored at the drumbeat for the war that I was watching at home. And I was also watching, and I was watching Fox. I watch a lot of cable. Mm-hmm. And I just was stunned at the sort of unanimity of support for the roll-up to the invasion. I had problems with the bombing of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I felt that, you know, the most powerful nation on earth shouldn't be dropping bombs on people who live in caves, and that this is a rather indiscriminate way to respond to the horror of 9/11. And I just never anticipated the thunderous resistance to any suggestion that we shouldn't, you know, that we somehow should take a breath here before we proceed with this militaristic response to the attacks on the United States. Anyway, I went back, and the show didn't do badly. We certainly weren't Elvis. We did not burn the town down. But the numbers that we got entitled us, if you look at the general landscape of the way decisions are made in cable, We often were the highest rated program on MSNBC. We never came close to Fox, but neither did anybody else on MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
So in our own family community, we were often the tentpole for the evening. Not always, but often.
Mm-hmm.
And then a memo was leaked. The New York Times reported the memo and a number of other outlets. A survey was taken. There's a lot of surveys taken in cable by the management people. They will do a focus group, you know, overnight. I don't know, for several thousand dollars. They'll put 35 people in a room, and in 24 hours, they're going to know what people think of Bob McChesney. And this is what they do. The consultant memo said that MSNBC was never really going to succeed with Donahue opposing the war while all the competition was waving the flag. So that opposition to the war was seen not only as unpatriotic, not only as not supporting the troops, not only as kind of a demonstration of wimpiness, it was also seen as a way to get very low ratings.
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't a commercially sound thing to be promoting, to be featuring a program with a host who was anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt so naive because I'm a veteran guy. I've been on the air a long time, and I couldn't get over. There was real fear that the Donahue program was going to become a kind of a platform for the anti-war voice. I mean, not a concern, a fear.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the troops, by the way. Along the way, and it's, the point has to be made, you have to get the whole story here, we were not burning the town down, so I didn't have a lot of power. I was accustomed to power, because when we had our daytime show, my goodness, our ratings were so good that we really were able to get, I mean, it seems like another life ago when we had, I had this power. So it was very humbling for me to be dealing with a lot of pressure from upstairs, from the suits. And also, we had to feature two conservatives for every liberal.
Yeah, I think this is a point I want to, I'm glad you raised that, Phil, because, you know, here the memo suggests that your show might be sort of this rallying cry for people opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and not being sufficiently supportive of the Bush administration's policies. But at the same time, your show, and I was a fairly regular watcher of the show, had what seemed like a pretty strict policy that there at all times would be as many pro-Bush or conservative people on the panel as there were people who would be considered to the left of that or liberal, including you. I mean, you were
absolutely.
And so it wasn't, it was a standard that no other talk show has ever held to. I mean, no one goes on O'Reilly or Britt Hume and says half the people on screen at all time have to be critics of the Bush administration.
Right. Right. Well, remember, Fox is inoculated from this problem. Nobody's going to accuse Fox of not being a supportive, patriotic, flag-waving. There's been millions and millions of dollars spent to cast, for example, the Democratic Party as being anti-war, almost a girly man. and it's been tremendously effective. It is one of the reasons that Kerry was the deer in the headlights during this last presidential campaign. I am convinced that the people surrounding him, all of whom, Shrum, all of them, were veterans. These are veteran political people surrounding Kerry, and at the outs, I think the night after he got the nomination, they surrounded him in a hotel room, and they got in his face and they said, "Don't mess with this war."
Mm-hmm.
That is that. It's just. I mean, I can't get over war. Trumps everything. War turns everything upside down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, war. The war. They were able to cast Bush as the brave patriot, and Kerry as the war wimp. It's unbelievable what what they were able to do. And in my own case, by the time we got, by the time the troops rolled into Baghdad, we were gone.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, to wrap up the story for this part of the segment, your immediate replacement on MSNBC was a gentleman named, I believe, Michael Savage.
Yes.
Who's known for sort of, I don't know what the term is, hate radio. His specialty is basically attacking gay and lesbian people,
yes.
ethnic minorities.
Yes.
And he said anyone who criticized the war is a traitor. I mean, he's on record.
He not only said that, but he referred to, he hoped that the sodomite gay guy that called him would die of AIDS.
And this was palatable to management, apparently, but Phil Donahue was not.
He went too far. Although, I'm home watching this, and I wondered, you know, the MS means Microsoft,
yeah.
and MSNBC, and I've said to myself a number of times, do Bill and Melinda Gates watch MSNBC? I think that is probably one of the grossest. Forget about Phil for a moment. But the hiring of Michael Savage by the General Electric Corporation, and I know that these decisions are signed off on at the highest levels. I am convinced. You know, what happened to Phil was not the work of a program director. These decisions go all the way to the top. So that somehow somebody way up there passed on Michael Savage. And elicited really almost no comment from the mainstream press or the media press that are paid to comment on these things.
We're talking to Phil Donahue today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you over WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Phil Donahue, the number here 333-9455 and our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Phil Donahue needs no introduction, I think, to the vast majority of our listeners, unless you've come from another country in recent years. He's a legendary talk show host in the history of television for 30 years, most of them on national syndicated daytime programming, doing controversial programs, entertaining programs, and introducing, I think, in many ways, Phil, didn't you really revolutionize audience participation?
Well, we are proud of the fact that we really were, the first program to give the people who owned the airwaves in the first place an opportunity to use them. It was a radical idea called democracy.
Yeah, you know, I want to talk about it, but the other thing you did, and I don't think it's fully appreciated enough, and I'm a historian of broadcasting, so I'm well aware of this, is that what was considered palatable fare for daytime programming before you came along tended to be quiz shows and soap operas and, not pretty low-level stuff that didn't require a lot of gray matter to sort of swing into action to follow the ball. And I think you really changed the equation, if I may say so.
Well, I thank you. Our first show was November 1967, and you're right, this was a very sexist time. The view was that women cared really only about daytime television audiences, cared only about covered dishes and needlepoint. And we began our program in Dayton, Ohio, with no band and no couch, and nobody laughed at my jokes. And we inherited the audience, by the way, from the show we replaced. We replaced a variety show where you could wave and win prizes and so on. And we had the tickets were out. What are you going to do? So they came in and they sat there. And after about four or five shows, I realized that during the commercials, they were asking a lot of better questions than the host. So it wasn't some genius vision that moved us. You know, I just one day jumped out of the chair and ran out in the audience with a microphone, and that was clearly we never would have become the Donahue Show syndicated nationally without the audience. We learned that women were cared more about. Women were reading more sections of the newspaper than their husbands, and that. You know, and you're right. The other station was, you know, a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich, and Monty Hall would be giving her a prize on Let's Make a Deal.
That's the show I was probably watching.
Yeah,
well, I was young.
We are, but here I am with, you know, two talking heads and women sitting on folding chairs, two cameras, terribly boring visually. So we knew that we had the only chance we had was to come up with issues that really grab people, and so in that in that vein, our first guest was Madeleine Murray O'Hare.
Now, yet I don't think a lot of our listeners would be familiar with her. Now, just what an extraordinarily controversial choice that was then. I don't even know if you could make that choice today, frankly. But tell folks who Madeleine Murray O'Hare
Madeleine Murray O'Hare is the woman often described as the most hated woman in America, a Baltimore woman who brought to the Supreme Court a lawsuit claiming that the reading of official prayer in public schools, in the schools of her children, was unconstitutional. And she won. And launched one of the most fascinating biographies of America's 20th century. Madeleine Murray O'Hare would come on the Donahue Show, and she was on the show often. In fact, she was a guest at my 25th anniversary program, which happened in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Madeleine would come on and say, "There's no God, there's no heaven." She baited people. She could be a very unpleasant person.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't enough that she was saying things like, "There's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell. When you die, you go into the ground, the worms eat you, you biodegrade, and you become part of the physical unit." Well, my goodness, the building fell in. Everybody in Dayton knew there was a new television. We had a 50 share. It was unbelievable.
That means 50% of the TVs on in Dayton were watching your
Now, show. I want you to know, if there are TV people out there, they would want to know, I should say, there were two VHF stations in Dayton at the time and one UHF.
Mm-hmm.
You get it, and you have to be an older fella, I think, to understand what that means. But still, it was just a heck of an achievement. And people were just absolutely stunned, and everybody stopped. Nobody left the barber shop until the show was over. It was really something. We had done something nobody else had done, and along the way, we put a homosexual on in 1968. The first year of our program was 1968, the assassinations of, Kennedy, Bobby, and Martin, and the kids rioted in Chicago. The war was in rage. And we were in Dayton. I couldn't get celebrities. If we had been born in L.A., we probably would have tried to mimic all those other programs and never would have survived.
Yeah.
So you're right, it was the controversy, and it was... it was the issues that made us that drew the crowd that was large enough for the people who owned the program to decide to try and syndicate it.
We're talking to Phil Donahue today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and I guess I'd be a hypocrite at this point after talking about how you helped revolutionize audience participation if I didn't go immediately to our phone lines, where we've got four callers patiently waiting for a chance to speak with Phil Donahue. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yeah, I got two comments, and then... question. First comment is, I wanted for years to be able to talk to Phil Donahue and tell him what an inspiration he is. He's really, the way he could analyze comments of some of his guests and their repercussions and such were really inspiring. I thought for years and years, and he did that. It was just amazing. You said earlier that you were wondering about if Gates watches MSNBC. Another question might be, I wonder if people like Ray Suarez watches shows like Frontline and Now. And I got to ask him about that recently, and he said that he didn't have a very good answer for why there wasn't a lot of cross-pollinization between shows like Frontline and Now in the Lair Hour, and he basically said something about it having different audiences, that kind of thing. I wanted to put that out. But then here's my question, and that is that you started out by talking about how you were amazed at the war coverage, but isn't it the fault of these broadcast news consultants? Like, I understood that one, for example, McVeigh Media, a Cleveland-based consultant, told their clients to get patriotic music that makes you cry, salute, and get cold chills. And then there's Frank N. I think it's Magid or Magid Associates,
mm-hmm.
said covering war protests may be harmful to a station's bottom line, unquote. Could you talk a little bit about those, and I'll hang up, and thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Yeah, Phil, I mean, in addition, as you answer that about the war, just, I mean, this is probably something you've seen through your career, the use of, like you were talking about these focus groups earlier, but this whole phenomenon of using this sort of market research to drive right. content.
Right.
Well, Bob, I think if I just get, I don't mean to, you've come a long way without my saluting you, but I think this is just another reason why the work you're doing is just so very, very important. And, you know, my problems with dissent go back to the war, to the Vietnam War. We lost sponsors. We had sponsors that we've had stations that wouldn't carry Dick Gregory. I mean, it's unbelievable. In my own lifetime, we got a letter once from Bob Evans, a very nice guy and a very successful businessman, the Farm Sausage Man.
Sure.
I will not sponsor any programs that tear down America. I'll show you the letter. I mean, it was that simple to him. The First Amendment and dissent was not even on his radar. And that is the reality of millions and millions of Americans today.
Mm-hmm.
Shut up and sing. It's amazing. We've sent millions of young men and women to war, many of whom have died on foreign battlefields, to preserve and protect our way of life. An act of supreme sacrifice for which there are no possible remunerations or no expressions of gratitude that meet the level of that kind of pain inflicted upon their families and their loved ones to protect our way of life. At the center of that way of life is the right to dissent. If we don't use it, we're wasting their courage and their blood and their pain. My goodness, at a time of war, we need these voices more than ever. Doesn't mean we're right. No guarantee of that. But why, if you have to shut up and sing, then stop wasting these lives. And we'll get a Neo-Mussolini, and a lot of white guys behind closed doors will decide what's good for us. You know, what kind of country do you want? I'm just stunned at the knee-jerk way that so many proud Americans, many of whom are wearing the flag on their lapel, will not tolerate or respect any kind of dissent from administration policy, especially at a time of war when we need it the most. It's amazing to me. And now we've got media, as I don't have to tell Robert McChesney, we've got media, corporate media, absolutely standing at attention and saluting. We had the president of Walter Isaacson was named president of CNN. The first thing he did was fly to Washington and call on Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay, and other Republican members of the House and Senate with his hat in his hand with the message, we're not liberal. CNN is not liberal. We're not liberal. It is unbelievable how terrified they are of being called liberal. They see it as hurting the bottom line. They see to be a liberal is to be for organized labor. I mean, organized labor, can you imagine?
Phil, let me ask you a question. What do you think the chances are Walter Isaacson would have gone to Washington to tell Tom DeLay that one of the guests they'd be putting on the next month would be Madeline Marie O'Hare, one of her followers?
Well,
slim and none, or none and less than none.
You know, even worse, I think, it would have been tougher Madeline would have been accepted, I think, before Bob McChesney or Amy Goodman. Mm-hmm. I really mean that. I mean, in this environment today, they might have, but it's certainly true that she would not have been welcomed with open arms.
We're talking to Phil Donahue today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so you can call in with your questions. We will get to you if you do get through, so please be patient. 333-9455 is our number. 1-800-222-9455. Phil Donahue, of course, the one of the best-known talk show hosts in the history of television, recently the host of the evening show on MSNBC. And Phil Donahue will be here in Champaign-Urbana May 10th and 11th for the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Phil will be there with Seymour Hersh, John Nichols, Naomi Klein, Amy Goodman, U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders, Don Henley, Norman Lear, Bill Fletcher, Linda Foley, just a terrific group of people. If you want more information on the conference, the best way to get it is to get on the mailing list for this show, because we'll keep you apprised of it. And all you have to do then is email our current producer, Victor Picard, vpicard, P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu, and we'll get you hooked up. And while I'm talking about that list and our producer, Phil, I think the secret you know that isn't known to the general public is the key to any broadcast show isn't really the host or the guest or even the audience as much as it is the producer who arranges the guests and makes sure everything works seamlessly. And we've been very fortunate on this show, Media Matters, to have two great producers in the show's history. Ben Scott, who was here for the first year, and for the past 2 years, we've had Victor Picard. This is going to be Victor's last show, and I know a lot of our listeners know Victor, because he has so much on his plate. He's organizing the conference on May 10th and 11th. He's going to go to Washington this summer to work in Capitol Hill on media policy issues, really directing a lot of the work there, that he simply can't handle this job in addition to all his other duties. Plus, believe it or not, he's a graduate student. And Victor has done a phenomenal job, and he's going to be leaving us, but still be in touch. I think the next time he'll be on the show, he'll probably be a guest on the program. I want to thank Victor for the great work he's done over the years, and he's made the show really fly in the last couple of years. And getting guests like yourself, Phil, like Naomi Klein, like Seymour Hersh, both of whom will be on the air in the next few weeks. Replacing Victor, stepping into those big shoes, will be Andrew Boyle, who actually sat in and did several months of work a couple of years ago, and so he knows the ropes, and he's terrific. But for the time being, those of you who want to join our e-list, send your emails to Victor, vpicard, P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu, and he'll hook you up, and we'll get you on top of all the issues concerning the conference on May 10th and 11th that Phil will be at. We got Phil Donahue today as our guest here on WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Phil Donahue.
Oh, good afternoon. I wanted to ask about two different issues. One is about the way that the Donahue Show came up, the syndication, and I think the closest thing we have to that phenomenon now is the public access channels that are all carrying Amy Goodman and a lot of other really good material right now. Because I don't think that could happen anymore. I think I might have heard Phil say something about that in the past. But the other thing I haven't heard it discussed is the collaboration with Vladimir Posner. Now, I heard him on Radio Moscow, and he was very affecting, very great. I tuned in regularly to hear him because he knew America quite well. And I just wanted you to talk about that collaboration. It was sort of very close to the time where Reagan called it the Soviet Union, the evil empire, et cetera, et cetera. So that must have been a challenge to actually push that through the...
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to hear about that.
Oh, thank you.
Sure there are a lot of people in line. Yeah.
Phil,
thank
you know what? I think this proves your point earlier that callers have better questions than hosts sometimes. Those are two terrific questions.
Bob heard me talk about this on a recent panel in Seattle, and it is true. The Vladimir Posner came into my life in 1985, and then what ensued was one of the most important chapters of my professional life. And Vladimir and his wife Katya today remain personal friends and visit us just about every holiday season, and we often see them in the summer. Yes, we did our first space bridge. Somebody came to me and they said, "We will talk to Soviets," which they were in 1985, directly on live satellite with simultaneous translation. And I said, this is a KGB plot. It's important to remember how suspicious we were, the evil empire in 1985, when at a time when I was already perceived as kind of this lefty, kind of guy who didn't love America. You know, I mean, I already had baggage, and the last thing I needed was to be, you know, involved in a dupe for the KGB. So I was very concerned that this was a rigged situation, as we all were about. I mean, people in Moscow had to walk outside to talk, thinking that they were bugged. So I called Ted Koppelman. I said, "What do you think of Vladimir Posner?" He said, "I like him." Posner's first appearance on Nightline was 1980. Here was this guy who didn't sound like a Russian. And we went ahead, to make a very long story short. I hosted 200 people, Americans, in Seattle. He hosted 200 Soviets in Leningrad, then Leningrad. It was December 1985. Gorbachev came to power in April. We did this in December. Perestroika, Glasnost, the new Soviet Union, the new openness, and we just launched. And I was determined to prove this was legit. I wanted to know about Sakharov. Why was he in Gorky? Why do you trust old men behind wooden doors who you know what's good for you? You have no voice in your government. How do you tolerate? What about the Jews? You have to have Jew on your passport. Why aren't the refuseniks allowed to leave? And I mean, and the Soviet citizens in Moscow were looking, and, you know, the camera would pan them, and it looked like they were watching an auto accident. It aired in entirety across 11 time zones. It was one of the most thunderous television programs ever aired in the Soviet Union. Honestly, I can say without exaggeration. Vladimir got almost 100,000 letters. We barely got 46 markets to carry it here in the United States. They were much more interested in us than we were in them. We would later do Women to Women, Boston to Leningrad, all women. And then Vladimir came and appeared on my program. Vladimir, who had spent 38 years, essentially, and really, he was locked up in the Soviet Union. He couldn't leave. And he had gone to country and day school here in Manhattan. He went to Stuyvesant High School. And in the early 50s, his father, a Russian Jew who worked for MGM, the Red Scare was coming, and they fled. They literally fled and went to East Germany and then to Moscow. They arrived in Moscow like a week before Stalin died. So for a long time, and of course, by the time he got to Moscow, he had English cold. He was born in France. He had French. Vladimir speaks five languages without an accent. This is an amazing man. And he was the only person in the Soviet Union who knew who Joe DiMaggio was. Vladimir was a child of Manhattan Island. So he had this unique and always suspicious. The power in the Soviet Communist Party was very suspicious of him, always. They respected his talent. Vladimir translated John Donne for the entire Soviet population. So they appreciated his brain and his talent, but they were always suspicious. And he was a Jew, which is something you didn't brag about in along those years in the Soviet Union. So this is a surviving guy. This is a guy who's faced more tests than anybody I've ever known. And I just feel very grateful.
It was an extraordinary moment, I agree, in television history there in the late 80s. The first part of the question, Phil, from the caller was about syndication and how your show was really a syndicated show, not carried by a network, which I guess probably gave you a certain amount of liberty and autonomy. And it still remains a pretty widespread phenomenon, syndicated daytime programming. But there aren't many Donahue-type shows. They've been replaced by a whole different type of show where people like Vladimir Posner aren't going to be getting on the air unless they're going to be throwing mud balls at their wife.
I think this is important to understand the difference, especially for those who are interested in media reform. Syndication is a much more honest way to create and grow television programming. Syndication happens brick by brick. It happens market by market, station by station. If we had been, for example, if we had been born on the network in 1967, we were a local show. Remember this. We had only one place to go, and that was up. If we had been born on the network, imagine Madeline Murray O'Hara. I mean, after about 2 weeks, I think, a vice president while he's shaving could just end it in, before he even got to work. We would be gone. In syndication, if they get angry with you in Peoria, you're still on the air in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And the other station in Peoria might buy you. You go across the street, which the Donahue Show did many times over the course of our 29 years and 6,000 shows. That's, we did more than 6,000 shows. And if it sounds like I'm bragging, I am. It's a more honest way to do it. The price is negotiated in each market. A station can, you know, if the station is upset with you in any way, this is America, they're the customer, they can essentially fire you, cancel you, not renew you. Okay. Our salesman then, just like Willie Loman, would pick up the audition tape and go across the street to another station and say, here's Donahue, and negotiate the price. So I think it's Oprah syndicated.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's the honest way to go.
Now, we've got a full bank of callers, and I want to make sure we get to all of them. Our guest today, of course, Phil Donahue here in Media Matters. Let's go to the phone lines again. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Phil Donahue.
Yes, I hope that Bill will invite you back here, Phil.
Thank you.
You mentioned drumbeat to war earlier. What do you think of the current drumbeat for Social Security?
I think the president is losing.
Mm-hmm.
The air has gone out of that balloon. And the most they got out of it, and it's and we shouldn't be surprised, is a very effective spot which essentially accuses the Democrats of doing nothing. The president is making a lot of noise out of being this resolute man who's out there with big ideas. And it reminds me of the columns. Mike Royko used to write columns in Chicago about...
Sure, he's a well-known figure in these parts.
Oh, Mike Royko was... I moved from Dayton to Chicago in 1974, and I couldn't believe Mike Royko. I mean, that was the talk. That was an epiphany for me. I was staggered. I mean, if a cop roughed up a citizen, you had the cop's name, the corner of the street where it happened, the time of day, what he said, what she said. I mean, it was, we never had that kind of journalism. Never. I never saw it in Dayton. I never saw it. Of course, I mean, I was a reasonably young man at the time. I was hardly a veteran, but I was staggered by this guy. Royko used to write columns about foreign-born cab drivers in Chicago who didn't know where they were going and thought that the best way to get there was fast. I see the president that way. The president is getting high marks for being resolute, as in Social Security. By golly, he's resolute. But nobody talks about the fact that you got to borrow $1 trillion to make this work. It's not going to it will not necessarily prolong the viability of the program, and the windfall will accrue to Wall Street in much more dramatic way than the average citizen. So I do think he probably has overextended himself here. I'm not sure what the future will be in Social Security reform, but it's certainly not going to be privatization.
I mean, the other issue that it's often spoken about now, about where President Bush may have overplayed his hand as well as the congressional Republicans, is the Terri Schiavo case.
Yes,
what's your sense of that?
Well, I was surprised. It shocked me. I was impressed. I thought that, like Jessica in the well, remember the little girl who was...
Sure.
We're much more riveted by one face, one person than we are about millions in Darfur, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It rivets the mind. And Terri Schiavo riveted the mind. I think watching that 3-, 4-, 6-year-old tape, whatever it was, over and over again... millions of Americans said, wait a minute, this is way too intrusive. And then when the Republican Party and the on the Hill seemed to be riding it for its political value, they turned off in large numbers. I think that really, and then we had Tom DeLay actually choking up. I mean, he was choking up on TV in the House. On the floor of the House. I think eyebrows were raised. And, the pretense got so thick that millions of Americans just were turned off.
We're talking to Phil Donahue today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of callers. I promise I'll get to each and every one of you. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Phil Donahue.
Hey, this is a wonderful show. I'm sorry Victor Picard's leaving. Also, I say that beautiful statement that Mr. Donahue said about dissent and war early in the show. That was very moving. But I'm calling about basically, I wonder how many other journalists and media people have actually suffered in their careers because of this war, and to what extent does suffering become, at what point does it become being blacklisted? I'm wondering what that would be. I just, one other comment, I think often of what Fred Friendly said when he was alive. He said that he thought things went wrong with television when the investment bankers in Wall Street took it over. I wonder if you all would maybe comment on that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Phil?
Well,
what about other journalists? I mean, we know about you. We know Bill Maher lost his ABC gig
for a while
after the 9/11 thing. I mean, there's other folks who can add to that list, or is it more people who don't get hired, or journalists who have jobs who just are become afraid to say something?
What happened to Peter Arnett?
Yeah,
you know, I mean, here this guy was Pulitzer Prize stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Gulf One, he stayed. I mean, what's courageous to you? And he did a fabulous job. And they tried to make a big thing out of the, what was it, a factory that, I don't know, they claimed that they were hiding weapons in a factory that it turned out to be untrue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to presume that he's suffering in any way. I mean, Peter is a big boy, and he's come a long way without my advice. But I miss him. I think he was a veteran voice. That's just to name one. There's, you know, I my kids are raised, you know, if you have kids in school and a mortgage, you know, and bills to pay, it's very hard to swim against the stream. One of the reasons that corporate media gets away with so much is that the corporate media is the employer. I mean, when I was 25, 26 years old, you know, I wasn't banging up against too many walls. I was popping off, but I was watching it. I mean, I can remember, I covered Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And I can remember saying to a general, we have a 102. Why do you have to have an F-104? How come an F-105? And, of course, you know, that was as brave as I would get.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, well, the Russians, we have to keep ahead because of the technology. And I accepted it, and we moved on. But, you know, you don't rock boats when you're raising a family and when jobs are tough.
And when you see that Phil Donahue loses his job for what he did, or his show goes off the air and is replaced by a guy who's rabidly pro-war.
Well, you know, and also, as you and others have made so clear, first of all, there's a lot of very nice people working in corporate media, and they are very sincere, and they're smarter than I am, and they've had, you know, they've covered more things than I have, and often with great valor. And they stood there in front of the camera with the flak jacket. So you have to be careful. If you swing with a broom, you begin to look like a barroom bully who really isn't informed, and your message is not respected. But it nevertheless is true that the reporter today working for corporate media internalizes the values of the boardroom to which he ultimately reports. You know, we internalize these values. It's very tough to criticize. That's why it's so scary for corporate media to be thought of as liberal. Conservatives criticize government. Liberals criticize business. This is a very risky business to criticize business. especially if you're financially vulnerable, as most of us are, as certainly I used to be when I was chasing four-star generals at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
We're talking to Phil Donahue today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show. We've got three callers patiently waiting. I want to get to each of them before we go off the air. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Phil Donahue.
Hi, Phil. Hello to all my friends in San Francisco as it develops. And if you'd be such a good person to take up the question of the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000 and 2004, and the chances of building a mass political party on the left with or without media reform. And apparently we're going to see you in town very soon, and I'm anxious to see you, and I'll let you go. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Well, he just threw me this is a pitch over the plate for me. And it isn't that I'm going to hit it out of the park, but
You could reach the warning track, I bet.
I was on the bus. I was on the bus for Ralph Nader in 2000, my first campaign, first presidential election where I was not on the air. You know, when I'm on the air, I couldn't go out and pop off for one president or one candidate or another. And I was really thrilled at this. I was like a little kid. I loved it. I was at the rally in Madison Square Garden, the Target Center. We were at the Oakland Coliseum. It was fabulous. Huge crowds. I would introduce Michael Moore, and Michael Moore would. This is 5 years ago. Michael Moore was getting fabulous reception, standing ovations. I think it was before Columbine.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, he was very highly regarded, and we had Howard Zinn. Medea Benjamin. I mean, it was wonderful, the people that were on the bus with us. And I thought Gore was going to walk in. I mean, what is this, a one-and-a-half-term governor from Texas? I mean, I didn't think Gore had the slightest chance of losing this election. And kaboom, the New York Times wrote an editorial saying that, by the way, my wife supported Gore and the Democratic Party. And the New York Times literally wrote an editorial, upper left-hand side, that Phil Donahue should listen to his wife,
Marlo. I remember that. That was amazing.
And Marlo should give Phil a civics lesson. To this day, I am so curious to know, what would that civics lesson be? That I shouldn't support and follow my conscience and support the presidential candidate? With great reluctance, I signed the letter in 2004. I'm still not comfortable with it. I believe Ralph Nader is right on all the issues. I believe we are never going to take money out of politics as long as there are only two parties. I believe as long as there are only two parties, the fat cats are going to be able to shower both horses with money and have a win-win situation. I believe the refusal on the part of corporate media to allow Ralph Nader in the debates in the presidential campaign of 2000 was the greatest violation of the rights of the people and a kidnapping of the presidential campaign process by corporations, and should repulse every proud American. It was awful what they did. Can you imagine United Airlines, American Airlines, Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch? They didn't want Ralph Nader on this platform. Ralph Nader is for labor unions. Labor unions reduce the cost of your, reduce your profit and reduce the price of your stock. I mean, these liberals are pointy-headed people that don't understand free markets and economy. It's amazing what the hostility they had for Ralph, and they were successful in keeping him off. Why did I not get on the bus in 2004?
Yeah.
You know, I saw this war, and I saw these kids dying, and, I just couldn't, I had to compromise myself. I don't know how else to put it. I saw voting for Ralph in 2004 as compromising people for a principle. I couldn't have been more upset at the fact that the Democratic Party was hiding under the desk.
and afraid to come out and oppose this war. But I knew, I really felt that Kerry had a chance to bring more nations into, you know, here we had a Rummy calling old Europe, you know, we had a wise guy, Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
We're Fallujah, we're bombing mosques. Imagine if they bombed St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. I mean, we're recruiting Al-Qaeda. And I thought that this new face, Gore, would have a chance to calm this terrible turmoil in Iraq and in the neighborhood there, and save more American lives, reduce the heat, and enable us to withdraw and save more babies than would have been the case if I jeopardized Gore's ability to win by supporting Nader. Kerry's ability to win by supporting Nader.
We're talking to Phil Donahue in Media Matters. We've only got a couple minutes left. We have two very patient callers. Line 2, Coles County, I thank you for your patience. If you could make it quick, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, very quick. I think there's more than just one reason why a show like yours could not be a big success today. One reason is the turn to the right. That's a small reason. But I think the real big reason is the dumbing down of the country, particularly young people, but also the population as a whole. I think that's the real reason why a program like that could not be a really big success. What's your comment on that?
No, Phil, I've got an idea. Let me take the last caller, too, and then just jot down dumbing down. We'll get the last caller, and they can answer both of them at the same time. Yes, line 3, Eureka, Illinois, you're on the air with Phil Donahue.
Thank you. It's an honor, Mr. Donahue. Just a question and a comment. It seems to me the media has been more conservative now than any time in my memory, and I wonder if you could comment on that, and what specific signs of hope do you see in media besides Bob McChesney? Thank you.
All right. Hopefully I'm not part of the dumbing down problem.
Yeah. I delivered the commencement address to North Carolina State University a little over 2 years ago. And I was booed. And several students walked out. And you'll have to take my word for it. Here's just a couple of the things I said. I said that I thought the drug war was racist, that we have white cops knocking down doors in black neighborhoods and children are getting killed. And it's not fair to the cops, I said. I said I believed in the separation of church and state. I believe we have the most religious country on earth. More people pray. We throw more holy water, sing in more choirs. Time magazine features, religious figures on the cover. You're fighting, and the reason is because we separated churches. The founders were right. I support the framers. I'm the Republican, small r. I believe a woman's home is her castle. I was booed. I said, I believe Charles Darwin opened the greatest door, the largest door to the understanding of all life as we know it on earth today, and that people who talk to God every day are taking this most important scholarship out of biology textbooks, and this is dumbing our children who will never win a Nobel Prize, never be inspired to a life of science. You can't fix anything if you don't understand evolution. You can't contribute to the development of a vaccine. I was booed. Kids walked out. So we have a very well-organized, right-wing, Republican-sponsored campus organizing apparatus that empowers these kids. You know, I wish I could have walked out on somebody at my graduation. I would never forget it. These kids will have something to remember all their lives. It was a very dramatic, but wow, I was shocked. I mean, Raleigh, North Carolina, these are educated kids. And I thought about this. Why me, Lord? How come they came after me? And, you know, I realized that these kids are, what, 21, 22 years old? They've only known two presidents. You remember when Bubba came to power in 1992?
Phil, I have bad news, unfortunately. Okay. Yeah, we're here. The band is tuning up in the background. Phil Donahue, you've been a wonderful guest.
I wish we had more time.
Yeah, you've been a great guest, Phil. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll see you here in 4 weeks. I'm Bob McChesney. Have a good day.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In Champaign-Urbana weather today, partly sunny skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, high of 78 degrees, south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight with a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, low of 56, southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Partly sunny skies coming our way tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms also likely, high of 73, southeast winds 10 to 20. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy, low in the lower 50s, showers and thunderstorms possible. This is WILL Urbana.
It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is